The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
In a few minutes' time, we'll go on to hear the second part of the interview and hear about subjects such as how to avoid procrastination in learning. But first of all, to remind you what they covered in the first part, here's a summary of that first episode of this two-part special. This is Lydia El-Khoury and Barb Ann Oakley talking about how you can help your children to learn.
I grew up hating math and science with a passion, so I flunked my way through elementary, middle, and high school math and science, which is really ironic since I am speaking with you here today as a distinguished professor of engineering. I joined the Army because I thought, well, the only thing I can maybe do that I really have a passion for is learning a second language. There I learned Russian. Aren't I supposed to be open to new adventures and new perspectives? Why don't I see if I can try a new perspective of the mind and learn in math and science? And I found that when I use some of these approaches from language learning to learning math and science, it made a tremendous difference. And over the years, I've done many different things. I worked as a Russian translator on Soviet trawlers, met my husband at the South Pole Station in Antarctica. I always say I had to go to the end of the earth to meet that man. But I think what is important for all of us to recognize is that there are simple tools and tricks to learning that are simply not taught by schools.
You to explain a little bit about how you brought them, the different disciplines all together to get to your very niche field of expertise now.
We're often directed towards one area of study. You know, you have to be an engineer, you have to be a doctor, you have to be a lawyer. It is invaluable to not let yourself get put into a career box, and to also just keep your mind open to, you know, learning new things and being adventurous about new things.
Can you tell us how do we start thinking about learning to learn?
Look at the bolded words. Look at the chapter sections. Look at the pictures. Read the captions. And just get a little bit of a sense of where that particular material is going. And that will help you to have a kind of a framework that you can hang your ideas on as they are developing. So we have these illusions of competence. We're looking at something, we think we know it. Only later on, when we take a test, do we realize, no, we didn't know this at all. Well, what he was doing was something called interleaving. That is, doing somewhat similar kinds of problems, or which technique do you use at a particular time? So you can do each one individually if you're told that that's what you're supposed to be using. Like for this problem, use a binomial. But you don't get used to how do you yourself select which technique to use. Should it be binomial or should it be geometric? Interleaving means mixing things up while you're practicing, so you also learn which tool to choose as well as how to use that particular tool. Hundreds and hundreds of studies have shown, however, that retrieval practice is far more powerful than we ever thought it was. We used to think, oh yeah, simple rote learning of vocabulary words in a foreign language or anatomical terms or something. And it's like, nope, guess what? Retrieval practices is the best way for your child to learn anything. And so retrieval practice is really, it's this really mild, low-stakes way of studying on your own. And what they found is that if students suffer from test anxiety, the best tool to reduce test anxiety is to use retrieval practice during your studies. If you can also speak, so to speak, a little bit of mathematics, all careers doors are open for you. If you don't learn the math, then only a certain specific, often less high-paying group of careers are open for you. Most importantly, interleaving approach to learning math so that you really get those ideas down into what's called the basal ganglia procedural system. So like you know your multiplication tables by heart, and then you don't actually have to think very carefully because fractions can come more naturally because you know your multiplication tables.
Or the idea that you're genetically predisposed to maths. You're saying it can just be overcome by hard work, bit of grit and application. Is that right?
And some people are gifted, for example, at having those incredible reflexes that allow them to become extraordinary race car drivers. But does that mean that none of us bother to learn how to drive because somebody can drive better than us? So you don't need to be the best. You just need to know the fundamental basics and know them really well. And then that can open the career doors of your real choice.
Do you think the same thing applies for art, for the English language? Do you think it extends beyond maths as well?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody needs to have some fundamental education involving math, involving literacy, involving music, art, and things like this. We now know that the way educators have been teaching students how to read for decades with whole language approaches have actually crippled many students' abilities to learn to read. They're just beginning to come around to, it's important to use a little rote work to understand the, to remember the multiplication tables, just as you use a little rote work to remember how these letters sound. And then you can move forward.
So much pressure is put on teachers to achieve so much in a very short space of time.
Well, teachers have my deepest admiration. They are on the front lines of trying to move society forward. The difficulty for teachers is when new insights come about how, like this insight that new learning helps students feel better, that's coming from neuroscience. But a lot of teachers, they're already out, they're working, they've been trained. How can they learn about these new ideas? So it's adults learning as well as children learning. And there's magnificent materials that are brand new that are available online that can help much more quickly onboard us into this fascinating new world of how to learn effectively in ways that, can save people time and give them more time for fun. Teachers will often complain that, those neuroscientists and those cognitive psychologists, all these buzzwords and terms they use, and it's no fair for us teachers because, they need to translate it into our way of thinking. But what teachers don't realize is they use all these buzzwords and terms that need to be translated so that parents can understand.
They're expected to deliver the highest results possible, and the pressure on schools is pretty immense.
Absolutely. It being a teacher is a tough job, but at the same time, the impact you can make in helping children's lives, it's invaluable.
It makes complete sense, Barb, and you've totally convinced me. My kids are.
If children don't like doing that extra math, the trick is you're keeping it short. So like 20 minutes, you know, at most a half an hour extra math study a day, it's just not that big a deal. We now know that the brain has two fundamentally different modes of thinking. So one is focusing, that is using task positive networks, as psychologists call it. And the other is this default mode network. Sometimes I call it diffuse mode. It's more relaxed way of thinking and mind wandering. There is evidence that the more you focus, if you focus all the time, you actually suppress that default mode network.
And we hope that summary helped remind you of what we covered in the first part of this two-part special. We're going to take a short break now, but when we return, Lydia will be back with Professor Barb and Oakley, and they'll be covering the subject of how to avoid procrastination when it comes to learning.
Welcome back to the Parents Show, and we are delighted to have Professor Barbara Ann Oakley joining us, speaking about how to help our children learn. So, Barb, I've made so many little notes to myself about what to do based on what you've told us so far, and it's incredibly accessible and understandable and helpful. The next problem I want to ask you about is putting off learning. So I don't know if everybody else is in the same boat. When I was studying, my room was the cleanest it ever was. When I didn't have study to do, it was a complete mess. So I was gifted at putting off getting down and knuckling to learning. And it looks like my children might have picked up that habit too. So how important is it to knuckle down, stop procrastinating, and be disciplined in approaching your learning?
Well, there's ways to sneak up on your brain, and the tricks your brain pulls, or your children's brains pull, that lead them towards procrastination. And so, like, telling kids to knuckle down and, you know, is that's what we want to do. But sometimes what we want to do can actually lead to pushback.
Okay.
So I'll just kind of give a little bit of insight. What happens when you even, or your child even just thinks about something they don't like or don't want to do? It activates an area of the brain, the insular cortex, that experiences pain. So what does the child do? They switch their thoughts to something more pleasant and they feel better almost instantly. It's also procrastination. And so, you know, it's an easy thing to fall into, because it's just like, hey, I hurt, I changed my thinking and I feel better. It turns out that procrastination, I believe, is the number one problem of students everywhere all around the world. And everywhere I go, that is borne out. They'll be like, oh, no, we're in Kazakhstan. We are the number one procrastinators. You know, you go to Norway, no, we're the number one procrastinators. So, you know, I think that's encouraging for us parents to just know that it's a very, very common problem. So what I just do is, and I think this is very helpful to do before the procrastination actually happens, is to teach children how to use what's called the Pomodoro technique. This was invented by Francesco Cirillo in the 1980s. It's super simple. It's super effective. And it's and here's how you do it. You teach children that when you do a Pomodoro, you turn off all distractions, so no cell phone nearby, nothing popping up on your computer, and then you just set a timer, and work as effectively as you can for 25 minutes. And then when you're done with those 25 minutes of focused attention, you take a five-minute break where you do not focus on anything. I mean, you can go make a cup of herbal tea, you can listen to some music, but you do not turn to your cell phone or you know, to respond to messages or anything, you just take a 5-minute break. And what that 5-minute break is of not focusing, it allows the hippocampus to reinforce the learning that has just taken place. You can't feel, well, sometimes I feel like I can almost feel it happening. I'll be reading a book and then I look away for a little while and just let the thought settle in. And I sometimes feel like I can almost feel it happening. But if you teach your child how to use this Pomodoro technique, then the child can, come home from school, they do some stuff, and you just say, okay, let's do a Pomodoro. The idea of the Pomodoro is not, let's do your homework now and get it all done. It's a process thing. It's, let's just take 25 minutes and kind of work on something. And anybody can do this 25 minutes plus a 5-minute break. This is, in our Learning How to Learn basic course, we've had over 3 million students, and I literally have gotten thousands of emails from parents and students saying, this technique, this Pomodoro, has changed my life. And it's so simple to do. Even as parents, what we can do is we can model doing a Pomodoro with our children. Let's say that we are trying to learn about the platform that they use. So we set a timer, we're learning about that platform, and we're like working on it. And then our child can be working beside us as they see us working. And they see how we're not being distracted. You know, if we do think of something we have to do, we just make a little note. So you're modeling for them what that 25-minute Pomodoro looks like. Now, if your child is young, let's say your child is 10 years old, a good rule of thumb is however old your child is, add 1 minute, and that's a good attention span. So like if they're 10, they could do 11-minute Pomodoros. But it's a little bit nonlinear. So by the time they're about 13, 14, 15, they can do regular 25-minute Pomodoros, and that can be very effective for them. So just there's wonderful Pomodoro apps out there, and it kind of gamifies the idea of Pomodoro use. And Pomodoros are great too, because what they're doing is they're allowing for periods of focused attention and for that diffuse default mode activity for those 5 minutes after the 25 minutes. So it's a very clever way of intertwining what we know about how the brain focuses most effectively without multitasking for 25 minutes, and then that 5-minute break. A good Pomodoro app that I frequently hear people love is called Forest, but there are many, many Pomodoro apps that can allow kids to, gamify and collect Pomodoros as they're working on them.
Thank you, Barb. That's really, really, it's a great tip, but it's also, I think, achievable. I think nobody's going to run away from a 25-minute focused learning followed by a five-minute break. I mean, it's very achievable in everybody's day-to-day life.
Exactly right. That's the thing is, especially the younger the child, the smaller the periods of focus that you encourage them to do. And it just makes learning, it's not this monster thing where, I've got to cram for, 10 hours to prepare for this test. No, the best thing, in fact, I should say, spaced repetition, that is doing retrieval practice over a number of days, is really important. Like if a child has 5 hours in a week that they can study a topic, they should do 1 hour a day for 5 days, as opposed to 5 hours in one day. Because cramming 5 hours in one day you don't get strong neural connections, and those little synaptic janitors can sweep those weaker connections away. Whereas what happens is each day as you study, well, that night, what happens is your brain will send little, mostly electrical signals down the axons that jump the synaptic gap. But in other words, they'll send signals hundreds of times over the neurons that are being used to remember and to understand whatever the student is learning. So practice during the day kind of tells the brain, oh, this is what's important. Then sleeping at night, the brain will run little signals over those runways. The next day you practice again. That night as you sleep, it runs signals over the runways. And if you do that over a number of days, that can really help strengthen that neural framework that's at the heart of good learning in a way that just cramming will never do. A little tip is right before a student goes to sleep at night, they want to they should do their regular study during the day, not at the last minute before they go to sleep. So I want to make that clear that that's not what I'm saying here. What I'm just saying is in the 2 to 3 minutes before a student goes to sleep, they want to draw back to mind, try to retrieve the key ideas that they are trying to learn or remember. What this will do is signal the brain during the night, practice with that stuff because it seems to be important for our person somehow. And then if you really have it, or if you have the moments to do this, 2 to 3 minutes again when you wake up in the morning. And this will help a student to get those key ideas more effectively and efficiently. So that little pause and practice right before sleep can be a very elegant way of helping speed one's learning.
Thanks, Barb. And is that what you'd call internalizing the information, when you can kind of stop looking at the page, think about it, and kind of embed the knowledge in your brain? Or please correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think you've really laid it out very clearly there. If you look at artificial intelligence and natural language processing and our ability to understand the real definitions of words and terms, it's all really pretty fuzzy. It's just that people normally, when they think of memorizing, there's a bit of a connotation sometimes that it just means memorizing it without really understanding it. Like you may memorize, a formula, and you don't really understand the formula. But poets will sometimes say, memorize a poem and you will understand it more deeply. So I think it's important to memorize formulas. But as you're memorizing it, you also kind of try to think about what you're memorizing in the same way a poet thinks about what they're memorizing when they're memorizing poetry. You know, this is let's say that kinetic energy is proportional to the velocity squared. Huh, well, that's interesting. And, why is that? Thinking about that, thinking about what is in the formula that you're memorizing. So when I say internalizing, it's really quite close to memorizing, but it's also just got that additional connotation of, what does it really mean insofar as we can really understand, what that formula means, as you're memorizing it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for explaining that. So how important is a a positive, healthy working or kind of learning environment at home for study. Can you learn anywhere? Does it matter if you're on the sofa or should you be sitting at a desk giving it your full focus? Do you think it makes a difference?
Oh, gosh. You know, should I let out? I'm just sitting on my bed here as I'm speaking with you. I'm really relaxed and yet totally focused.
Yeah.
So I think you can, you know, it isn't necessarily important that you sit up at a desk, you know, in a certain place. In fact, studying in different places has been found to be really a helpful approach to studies because you can sometimes sort of pick up parts of your environment as you're studying things. And then when you go to take a test in a different room, in a different building, some things may not come as easily because you're always used to doing it in one location. For example, your bedroom where you're studying or wherever. So I think it's just valuable to have a calm and quiet environment. You want to, you know, and to be supportive of your child. And I think most parents really are. And that's the big thing, as opposed to, you know, where perhaps that they're studying. Just kind of you're supporting, you're encouraging, and that their success is something that, you know, as long as they're trying really hard, that is a great thing to your mind. It's not, you know, that if they come home and they've got a 98 as opposed to 100 on a test, that's not a big deal. And if your child is not so good in an area and they pass the test, that may be something that you celebrate. Yeah. But I'm very grateful that my parents allowed, they tried to help me, like with my math. They'd get a tutor and so forth and try to encourage me. But at the same time, they were not these monomaniacal parents who also felt that perfection in learning was super important. And I think that helped me with my creativity in the long run. They just wanted me to, you know, be successful, you know, as in not flunking out of things. But they, you know, I do find that sometimes, like my engineering students who are the most perfect ones are not the most creative ones. They're not the best engineers. It's the ones that are, you know, that don't just focus on the grade, but actually, well, sometimes they're miserable students, but they go on and they're super creative. And so even when they're miserable students that just kind of get their little thing that they go off on and like to study or do that may not actually be related to what I'm teaching. I remember one of my worst students in electromagnetics won the Boss Kettering Award from GM for the most creative, one of the most creative products from GM. And, you know, it's okay if students aren't, you know, and I guess this just brings up another important point is students with dyslexia, students yeah. With autism spectrum, students who have attentional difficulties, we can often think that they're purposefully somehow just like not paying attention and being scattered and so forth. And it's not their fault. It's the way their brain is designed. And if we can find ways to help bridge them into learning, we are doing society a great favor. Did you know there are Nobel Prize winners with severe dyslexia, you know, with autism spectrum disorder, with attentional difficulties, won the Nobel Prize. And yeah. It's because of, not despite or along with, you know, their perceived dysfunction that allowed them to be so tremendously successful in what they were discovering or creating.
That's it's such a lovely reminder, Barb, to that how important it is to ease off on the pressure and how counterproductive it can be, and a great reminder about, I mean, we focus on special educational needs and children, and both children and parents regularly on the Parents Show, because I think they don't often get the credit that they're due for the extra challenges they have to go through and the lack of understanding by often other parents and other students for the extra challenges that they have.
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, so it's just so, you know, if I can just recommend again, you know, to take a look at Uncommon Sense Teaching, the specialization. We show you how, for example, the brain has two major pathways that it lays down those neural links in long-term memory. One is procedural through the basal ganglia. The second is declarative through the hippocampus. So you don't need to remember those. All you need to remember is some kids have a better procedural system. And then they can learn better in the procedural ways of learning, which means they know how to do it, but they can't explain it. And that's actually perfectly okay, because the other system of learning, the declarative system, which those with dyslexia can prefer to learn with, that makes it easy to explain things. So those with, you know, who learn well declaratively, they can explain exactly what they've learned. Those who learn well procedurally learn it really well and can't explain it. And yet often, because teachers and the educational system has not understood that this procedural system is a super important system for learning, teachers are often instead just taught, well, if a student can't explain it, they don't know it. That's not true, but it's what they've been taught. And so, you know, they put students into this box where they have to use this, you know, if you can't explain it, you don't know it. Then, for example, a child who's more on the spectrum can grow more and more frustrated with the educational system, and where they should have been leapfrogging up because of their potential and abilities, they instead can turn off the educational system because they're like, well, I can't explain it very easily, so I must be dumb. And it's like, no, you're not. You're super smart. You know how to do it. I think the more that the educators know about how children really learn and the differences and what is going on with neurodiversity, the better off our children will be.
Thanks, Barb. I have to admit, I didn't know that about the differences between the two as well. So that's really, really valuable to know. So, Barb, I want to ask you about social media. So I think a lot of parents out there are concerned about the flood of dis and misinformation that our children are being exposed to. And it's more important now than ever before for them to think critically and to think, you know, is this true? How do I find out if it's true? Can I trust this person? Can I trust this source? Is this something like an ability that we can instill in our children as parents, get them to think more critically and think twice before they believe something that they're told?
It's absolutely something that we can do, is to help them to learn to think more critically. So this takes us back momentarily to those two very different systems of learning, the declarative and the procedural, hippocampal versus the basal ganglia. These systems learn very differently. And so the declarative hippocampal system, we're very aware of. It's like our logical step by step. We learn how to do something because someone is explaining something. But that procedural system is like you do lots of practice. Like you practice with the Rubik's Cube to learn how to do it because it's not something you can explain very easily. What happens with that procedural basal ganglia kind of practice learning, experiential learning, learning from lots of inputs, is that you can't explain it. It's there. You have this knowledge. It's where your internal intuition can come from. Like you practice with lots of problems, you see a new problem and you go, oh, well, yeah, you just do this. It's because that basal ganglia system is giving you that insight, even though you're not conscious of it. Now, when it comes to critical thinking, what's happening is critical thinking means thinking step by step, logically. You're conscious of what you're thinking. But what can happen to your conscious critical thinking is you can be subconsciously biased by that procedural system. It's where that, remember, the intuition comes from. It's where all your experiential kind of learning comes from. And also just that, you know, lots of data input. In fact, you learn how to speak your native language largely through that procedural system. That's why you can speak rapidly, intuitively, without even thinking about it. But anyway, when it comes to critical thinking, that if you're not careful, you can be biased and you're not aware of it because it happens through that unconscious procedural system that's had all this built-in information from all your previous experiences. So it is a very good thing to teach children to, number one, they need to have different sources. There's actually kind of a lot of, so we cover in Uncommon Sense Teaching, we talk about critical thinking and how to teach it. Let me see if I can pull up very quickly. There's a wonderful book for kids by Julie Bogart about how to teach your child critical thinking. It's called Raising Critical Thinkers, A Parent's Guide to Growing Wise Kids in the Digital Age. And she talks about the value of like analyzing the source. Who's saying this? What are their own motivations? And what are some differing critical perspectives? Really, what you want to have is more input into that basal ganglia system. You know, like you don't always want to hear one side's opinions about something. You want to also be, well, as they have said in the old days, so aware of the other side's perspectives that you could also argue their side. And we often, I think we unfortunately can get insights into the other side's opinions that present them in the worst possible light. And yet we think that's actually the other side's opinions when it's not really their what they're thinking or doing at all, or it's a really distorted version. So it's just a quick way of saying, you know, it's just like a boss. You never just listen to one side of an argument. You want to hear both sides and try to step back dispassionately and look at, you know, what are the differing motivations of these different individuals? Teaching this kind of thing is something that is difficult to do, but it can be done. And again, if you take a look at Uncommon Sense Teaching, we give you some insights into how to raise critically thinking kids. And also take a look at Julie Bogart's great book.
Fantastic advice. Thank you. Thank you so much, Barb. And on the idea of critical thinking. So, I mean, I've listened to interviews with you before, and how important is it?
I have known people who really couldn't do a mathematical problem to save their life, and yet they're very good critical thinkers. And I've known people who are really fantastic at mathematics, and they can't really think critically at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that having a statistical or a good quantitative background can help with being able to think critically, but it's certainly not the be-all and end-all. You know, I've known taxi drivers who showed way more common sense than people way out the extremes with, you know, with their doctorates and so forth. So I think it really goes back to trying to become aware of that unconscious bias and being willing to. It can make you feel super uncomfortable to look dispassionately at both sides of the story or whatever is being thought about. But you really have to be able to get yourself to let go of your feelings and try to look objectively. And the thing is, it's hard to do because you can fool yourself and say, you know, it's easier to think in a way that doesn't like acknowledge another person's perspective as being viable. It's painful to do that sometimes. So it's just easier. I mean, I've known super smart people who, my hero in science is a man named Santiago Ramón y Cajal. And he said, and he had ADHD, he had, you know, clear evidence of dyslexia, he had all sorts of problems. But he actually kind of persevered through all this, won the Nobel Prize, and is now considered the father of modern neuroscience. And he was asked, well, you know, sort of like, how the loser like you actually become successful? And it wasn't so many words, but it was kind of in so many words. And he said, well, number one, I was persistent. So he used retrieval practice. That was super important. Like when he's a beautiful artist, but he would look at what he saw in the microscope and then he would try to retrieve it to draw it. He'd look back and retrieve it to draw it. And that's how he began to understand what was really going on in the, with our nervous system. But I practiced, I was persistent. And then he said, when I was wrong, I could flexibly change my mind. And he said, I was no genius. But he said, I have worked with many geniuses. And the challenge with geniuses is they're super smart, really brilliant. They get an idea in mind. They jump to conclusions to get that idea. And when they're wrong, they cannot change their mind. And indeed, there is evidence from neuroscience that not only in humans, but you know, in everything from fish to birds to mammals, that the faster you are as a thinker, the less accurate you are and the less flexible you are. So in other words, you jump to conclusions and when you're wrong, you can't change your mind very well. And there's good neural evidence for why that takes place. A person that has, for example, a really good memory, super good memory, they can be super faster learners. And those little connections stay in place. The dendrites don't melt away and allow you to forget. The slower learners, they think, oh, I'm just not as good. I got to relearn this stuff. And Fred is so fast with this and I just can't compare. But the slower learner, they have to reform those dendritic spine connections. They have to keep redoing it. And this allows them to be more flexible because it's like, okay, oh, I got to relearn it. Wait a minute. No, my diagnosis, my medical diagnosis wasn't quite right there. It could be this. Whereas the really super fast learner, a medical doctor, makes a diagnosis, locks it in, and they can't change your mind very easily. So there are slow learners, for example, Friedrich Hayek, and of course, my beloved Santiago Ramón y Cajal, slow learners, you know, really couldn't compare with, you know, some of the other, but because they were slow, they saw gaps, they saw inaccuracies that the really fast learners just jumped right over. And it was seeing those gaps and being able to flexibly and honestly and think about them with a critical thinking perspective that allowed them to do their brilliant work and make their critical insights.
That's, I'm sure there are so many parents who are listening who are slow learners who are going, ha, see, that's me. It wasn't bad that it took me longer to get things in place. But it's just fascinating, really fascinating to hear. And you know, reassuring for some. I think I'm probably one who locks in ideas a little bit too much, too quickly. But great to reflect on these, on the different types of learners. Barb, we're coming towards the end of our interview, and we have really milked you for every little bit of knowledge we can get out of you. I apologize, but I'm not done. I've got one more question for you. You've not only delved into these topics professionally and with your expertise, you've brought up children, so you really know firsthand how it is to grow their ability to learn. Now, I think none of us want to be helicopter parents or tiger parents. I think we really just want to put the measures or the scaffolding in place for our children to take the learning and run with it. So I've learned so much about from you. So when you said, you know, broaden your passions, not just following your passions, keep your mind open and don't be put in a career box. You know, the illusion of competence. I love the idea of bearing that in mind when you're going into tests. How important retrieval practice is. It's brilliant. I'm going to go on all the websites that you've told me about, and in particular, check out the Pomodoro technique. But any other last minute tips for us parents out there about growing our children's ability to learn without doing it for them? Because I think that's the biggest danger, that some parents might just get in there and try and do the learning for them, which I think would be probably a very cruel thing to do.
Oh, well, you have really touched on a lot of the key ideas. And one thing I love that you've brought up is that idea of critical thinking. So I have to tell you about one time where I was a helicopter parent. And I was like, oh my goodness, I'm being a helicopter parent. And it was my daughter had turned in a report. And this is my very verbally gifted, you know, she's really good. And she turned in a report and she'd gotten a C on this report. She'd worked hard on it. And they wouldn't give it back. They just said she got a C. And I was like, oh, she couldn't get a C. She's a really good writer, blah, 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 blah. You know, so I did the helicopter parent thing. And I want to see this thing, you know, because it was a little odd that they wouldn't give it back.
Yeah.
And then I read it and I went, oh, well, actually, you know, this is worth a C. It's not really that good. So it was important to be a critical thinker then and step back and realize that, yeah, I had my own inclinations, but you know what? The honest facts were it wasn't that good of a report.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I think, you know, I'm just laughing. It's my one incident of helicopter parenting, and it was like a disaster. So, I turned out to be the one who was wrong. But, you know, what I think it's important to do in parenting of all sorts is just, you know, encouraging, realize that you do not have to be their best friends all the time. That sometimes the best way to be a parent is, you know, you don't want to work them all the time, but that bit by bit practice over many days, nobody's going to come and say, you know, like when they're in 10th grade or something and say, hey, look, you've done 10 years of, you know, bit by bit, you're not going to get any championship for this. But it's that bit by bit parenting of encouraging, cajoling, and sometimes, you know, nudging quite firmly to, you know, with those little bits, that makes a tremendous difference over the years. And if I can put a plug in for math, you know, try to remember it's easy to say, well, my kid's good at everything except math. But nowadays, you know, that even if you go into communications or something that has nothing to do on the surface with math, all the best paying jobs and just a lot of career opportunities involve at least a modicum of analytical skills. So, you know, just remember, your kid may not thank you now. In fact, they probably won't, but they will thank you in the long run. And they may actually also say, and why didn't you also encourage the music?
Oh, brilliant. Thanks. Thanks so much, Barb, for giving us your time, your incredibly valuable advice and your expertise. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. These are the finest sets of questions I think I've ever encountered. So I just can't tell you how what a treasure it has been to share with you today.
All our pleasure. Thanks a million. Thanks, Barb.